Welcome to Talking Story. I'm Lynn Hadley, your host, and today we are happy to have the very talented and petite Laurie Johnson here with us today.
Well, thanks, Lynn.
She is a vintage clothing and accessory collector, conservator, and educator, and having had assembled a magnificent array of antique items for ladies that dates back as far as the early 1800s.
Yes.
Welcome,
yes,
Laurie.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Let's get started with telling us about what initiated your passionate journey in this direction.
Okay, a couple of things. I loved sewing and loved fabrics, and I made most of my clothes in high school, including two prom dresses, completely lined and everything. So I understood workmanship, fabric construction, and just the beautiful fabrics. Then I was in an antique store in Missoula, where I basically got started, and there was an old trunk in the back, and I was looking for something for Halloween, actually. And so I was going through, and I thought, oh, wow, these are pretty interesting. And so I pulled out a couple, and I asked the guy, you know, well, what are you charging for these? And he said, oh, $5 a piece for anything in there. Oh my gosh, I wish I had bought everything in there, but I didn't. I bought two pieces, which I have to this day. One is a lovely black chiffon 1920s with the little sailor collar. Fit me perfectly. The other is a periwinkle blue hobble dress from about 1913 or so.
What exactly, for those of us less immersed in the vintage clothing area, what is a hobble dress exactly?
Well, it was about 1912, 1913 that the dresses, they had kind of come down to the ankle, and they actually were not so much tied, but definitely narrower down there. And so they had to walk with little steps, almost as if they were hobbled. That style and fad quickly went away. Good thing.
Yay. So that fortunate incident led to quite an extensive collection, from
yes.
what I understand.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And, but let's see. Do you find these things with such regularity, or is it really quite an effort to locate this sort of thing?
Well, it's not an effort. It's more or less a passion that the car automatically turns whenever there's a garage sale or estate sale or an antique shop or whatever. And I love the fabrics, and I think, and seeing the workmanship, having actually built gowns myself, I have just a strong appreciation for what women went through when they were actually stitch by stitch, needle and thread, not any of the conveniences that we have today. So I love the older pieces.
A true fabric art form.
It is. It is. And I think that the women who created these dresses, in the whole, mostly women. If you have a tailored suit, it would often be men because they were more into the tailoring and structure, whereas women were making clothes for their whole family. They might be knitting socks for the husband and the kids, and they might be making cotton camisoles and petticoats, or even, you know, outerwear dresses, of course. And some of the early pieces that I have are phenomenal because of the hand workmanship.
And you're able to kind of not only locate those through with your passion and ability, but like refurbish and resurrect them. That takes a lot right there.
Yes, as you know. I was just soaking some things last night, and this morning I went in and all those little nitpicky stains are kind of coming out. And so I rinse them thoroughly, and don't use the washing machine, of course, or the dryer. And after they're washed, and you don't want to use any bleach or anything like that, rinsing several times, and then I roll the piece up gently in a towel and kind of pat it to get as much of the moisture out as possible. And the one that I just did that with this morning, I'm waiting to go home and iron it because it is hanging over a rack, and it's really critical, especially with linens, to iron them at just the right dampness. And anybody that likes ironing knows that, you know, but it definitely makes it come out beautifully.
Do you ever use starch? That just sounds like such an antiquated question to begin with.
Yeah, no. They say that if you do starch it, you have a more likely chance of attracting little bugs.
Oh.
You know, that will eat the fibers.
Oh, so that makes it more attractive.
So you want to rinse everything out of it and just have it as clean as possible. And the other thing is storage, because if you've got this 1900 or 1912 lingerie dress that is very fine cotton, and you do not want it touching anything with acid. And that could even be tissue paper that has acid in it, because a lot of people wrap everything in tissue paper. You want to get acid-free tissue paper. And when I got my first roll, I did buy it from the museum when I lived in Seaside. And I'm still using a lot of it because it's a lot of tissue.
Very good. Is there a certain kind of satisfaction in bringing these pieces back to life or back into the light, so to speak?
Absolutely. For me, it is just incredibly satisfying to see what was all rumpled up and might have had some stains, and somebody could say, there isn't anything we can do with this. This is a mess. And I try. And if it's still a mess, then okay, I've done my best. But most of the time, everything comes out beautifully, and there is a great deal of satisfaction of carefully ironing this delicate cotton organdy or something, because you don't want the iron to poke a hole. And when they are damp, they are at their greatest for fragility. You know, they can be very fragile because of that. And a lot of people think you automatically take it to the dry cleaner if it's old. No, because some of the chemicals that they use will create a disaster. So I always recommend hand washing and soaking to begin with to get out as much as you can.
Now, it's something like, not to get too far in the weeds or the stains, but is something like an OxyClean too much
for a delicate
fabric to soak in?
I don't think so. I haven't had any problem with OxyClean, and I do use that. The safest thing is to start with a liquid dish soap like Dove or what's the other one that cleans little ducks?
Oh.
Oh, yeah. It's blue.
That
Dawn.
One.
Dawn.
Yeah, Dawn. There
Dawn
we
is
go.
Supposed to be pretty good.
It just
good
dawned
too.
On me.
Yes. Good one.
Okay. Let's see. Not only do you bring these back to life, but you and add to your collection, which is extensive, but you actively utilize the pieces for educational purposes.
Yes. Yes.
Would you like to talk about the multiple programs that you've developed?
Yeah, and that is so much fun, because I have been asked to come to various retirement homes or retirement centers, church groups, women's business groups, schools, universities, especially during Women's History Month, is really nice for me, because I feel like this is an area that is so neglected in terms of recognizing the women that came before us, because we all have a great auntie or a great great grandmother back there that did a lot of this handwork, and I just think they need kudos, because they're really creating art, and it is an art form. As and I haven't seen it yet. I'm waiting to see the fashion wing of the Louvre in Paris. And of course, Victoria and Albert Museum in London, they have a huge collection, and it's just beautiful to see them. The clothes, I find, don't show as well just hanging up or on a hanger or laid out. And so the museums and so forth often have a great staff that knows how to handle everything very carefully and can put it on a mannequin. And then you can see the shape and the style. And some of those really early, early pieces in the 1800s are just amazing and beautiful. So,
and it just doesn't seem like we have the time these days to create anything, especially like the amazing laces.
Yes, the amazing laces. And that is one of my favorite programs that I do. And so I'm always on the hunt for lace. And it's just like anything. The more you handle it, the more you understand and can kind of read it. You know, prior, you know, years ago, you know, I would look at a lace and go, well, it kind of looks handmade, but, you know, I don't know. Or even a handmade piece that is made so well that you would think it's machine made. And they did have a lace machine in the late 1700s. So even if you have received something in inheritance and it's your great-great-grandmother's, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's, you know, handmade. You really have to examine it carefully with a magnifying glass to really see. And look at the backside, which is even more important than the front side, to determine that. So I love doing amazing lace, and I have several examples. I put them in acid-free sleeves so they can actually be passed around, that people can look at them close up as I'm talking. And I do Hanky Panky, which is all about hankies, and got to take a sip here. And people wonder, because my programs generally are about an hour, I don't want to overdo it. Of course, most of these things I could talk all day long about, but, you know, people aren't going to sit there that long. But even the hankies, you think, well, you know, 15 minutes, maybe you could talk about hankies, but I can go for at least an hour, because there is such a diversity of hankies, and they show us a lot about our history, you know, the social history of wherever you live. You know, at one time, a hanky would be given to the knight in shining armor to take with him into battle, you know, and it would signify certain things at other times. So I probably have in the neighborhood, the last count, probably 400 hankies. And I kind of divide them up into the for show hankies and the for blow hankies, because the show hankies you definitely do not want to blow on, and they're handmade lace, they're delicate, they're beautiful, and so those are wonderful to go to tea, or you have them for going out in the evening or something like that. And of course, at a time when proper ladies always had a hanky with them in their purse or whatever. Then you've got, that we all remember, the cotton floral hankies from the 40s and 50s, and they were the everyday for blow. And those are so easy. You know, I wash the hankies, and I love to see them all nice and ironed and crisp. And you ask about starch. No, do not use starch. Usually the fabric itself will be crisp and clean, just ironing it without putting any starch in it. So the hanky one is really a lot of fun, and it's the kind of thing that you can talk about because there's no size involved or age involved or anything. I mean, all women carried hankies, and it was the proper thing to do.
So. And I'm sure as you discuss the sort of range of quality and sort of fanciness that had to do with like a woman's like status.
Yes, it definitely did. Yeah, because some of the ones that I have, and I'm thinking of a black silk georgette. It's probably 10 inches square, and it's got the most beautiful, like a Chantilly lace edging it. And you just think, oh, I wonder who carried this, because each one of those hankies has a story of their previous owner. And that is really interesting to kind of imagine when you see it. Those floral cotton hankies, probably a lot of people remember their waitress in the 50s had a pretty hanky tucked in her pocket there that was always interesting.
Well, and then kind of coming full circle, it sort of seems like as we become more aware of how unearth-friendly it is to have such disposable things, such as plastics or, you know, tissue that we just kind of loft off into the waste can, that sort of thing is much more in vogue now.
It absolutely is. It should be, anyway, because we have become so much of a throwaway society that, you know, eliminating that part is really good. Go back to using real hankies. They're much nicer.
And I'd like to let you all know this is Talking Story on your Coast Community Radio. I'm Lynn Hadley, your host, speaking today with ladies' vintage accessory expert and educator, Laurie Johnson.
Well, I don't know how much expert is. The more you learn, the more you feel like you don't know. And some people can probably identify with that. The lace I absolutely adore because there is so much to learn. I was just reading a book the other night on the white work lace, and that's white on white. And it's so interesting, all the different names of the laces and the styles and so forth. And there is one called Normandy lace, and that came into vogue after World War One, I believe, and they were where it's where you piece the lace together and make a tea tray towel or a hanky or something like that. I saw one that this lady had made. It was a bedspread. It was exquisite, and I think I saw that online, and I think it was like $1,000 or something, but you can imagine the work on that.
Oh, well, first thing I thought of is that poor woman must have lost her eyesight doing that. Something of that volume. Now, and I'd like to talk about your book, Ladies Vintage Accessories, Identification and Value Guide. Mm-hmm. You highlight your collection and ensemble of the many magnificent pieces that you've been able to put together in the many decades of fashion. Is there any particular decade or accessory category? I noticed the shoes. I have to say the shoe category seemed a little extensive, but it was all wonderful. Is that a particular
shoes
fancy
are irresistible for me even today? You know, even today. Actually, it started out, and I researched the book and got it to the publisher the end of 2000, and no, it was sometime in 2000. It came out in 2001, and at that time, prices for vintage were quite a bit higher, and I loved the Victorian. Then as I learned more, then I kind of went, oh, you know, I really like the 20s. That was just so expressive for women. You know, they got the right to vote, and it was acceptable to do sports and all kinds of things. And, you know, 30s is also so interesting because of the bias cut and the influence of films. The dresses were so sexy and so gorgeous and made beautifully. So it's hard to pick a exact era. I am inclined to say the things that are handmade just touch my heart because I have some wonderful handmade pieces from the early. Well, think about it. When was a sewing machine invented? 1846. Well, everything before 1846 is a needle and thread up and down, you know, and they had voluminous dresses and they had a lot of things that had to be sewn. So pretty amazing.
Indeed. And now I'm going to quote you, and I would like for you to respond. As women gained rights and opportunity, it transitioned into their fashion. Mm-hmm. How do we see that?
Before women got the right to vote, they essentially were arm candy, you know, and the more high profile the husband was, if he was a banker or a lawyer or something like that, the way his wife dressed and her clothing was a symbol of being married to a man of power. The woman who was a pioneer woman didn't wear the hoop under the dress. She had a long dress, but it was usually just gingham or cotton or something like that. So when women got the right to vote, all of a sudden, and that was 1920, they threw off all their undergarments and, you know, I mean, they were wearing like one step in and a dress that was pretty flat, you know, it was very boyish. And they also were doing all kinds of sports. And they were even, back then, I was just reading the other night, they were even petitioning for equal pay for equal work. And the percentage is about the same because back then it was women would get about 75% of what men get paid for the same job. But look at what women have done since then. I mean, they've been in outer space and they're scientists and they've just done all kinds of things. So it's not so much gender, but today things are more casual and people dress more casually. You don't see women going out with matching gloves and hat and shoes anymore. That's it's fun, you know, to do it. And it's fun to wear hoop dresses and swish down the staircase, but it's not real practical.
Indeed. But I would like to talk to you more. I was fortunate enough to see your presentation the other day of the Abigail Scott Duniway.
Oh, yes,
and
yes.
Talking about the suffragettes. And who's and she's very important specifically to Oregon history women's history as well.
Mm-hmm.
But and you do it in costume.
Full era.
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 And how does that contribute to the program, to your taking on her persona?
If I was to come out and talk about Abigail Scott Duniway or Bethenia Owens Adair, who was the first woman doctor in Oregon, and I just had jeans and a jacket or something, it wouldn't work somehow. And I've spoken to lots of schools and kids. They are so fascinated with the clothing. And I always tell them now, it is not proper for a lady to show her petticoat, but I want to show you just a little bit of my petticoat. And it's just, you know, all that lace down at the bottom. And then these are the bloomers that they would wear, because they didn't wear like regular underwear that we wear. But they used bloomers and petticoats and these beautiful dresses. And they loved the shoes with the high button-up shoes or the lace-up shoes, which take me about 10 or 15 minutes to unlace, get my foot in, lace it all up again. And so somehow women had more time back then, or they had help.
Well, now it's clear you are a style antique clothing accessory expert and take responsibility for sharing the information these pieces have to offer. What does it take to compile these? I mean, you've got to do a lot of research on these, important characters from history.
Oh, yes, and I love that. I think I love the research, and I love reading about what women have accomplished with very little fanfare. You know, at the time of their lives when they're doing it, a lot of people, like with Abigail Scott Duniway, were still, say, go home, you know, take care of your kids and your husband, bake bread, can tomatoes, do that stuff. And it's just not ladylike or accepted to be out riding a horse all around the, you know, all around the countryside trying to get women to vote, because, of course, they were trying to get the vote for women when women couldn't vote that they wanted it. So they had to be very creative in talking to groups, and because it was actually the men that okayed it and agreed that women should have the right to vote. And that, to me, makes so much sense, because you're essentially having half of the population in control and making laws that affect oftentimes the other half of the population. And I feel like it's so important for young women and young boys to understand the importance of voting, because you are making laws and rules and so forth that will affect yourself in years to come, or your children.
Future generations. It's important.
Yeah, it is.
No doubt. And how, when did that transition from the collection into the actual like public programming
right,
that you do?
Right. I started in Missoula, Montana. I didn't have very many pieces, but I was asked to model in a fashion show wearing other people's antique clothing. And it was so much fun, because no matter what you put on, you become that person. So if you put on a early 1900s gown and you're supposed to stand up straight, and if it's, proper, if you have a corset on underneath or whatever, it makes you stand up straight. And the just wearing the clothing just kind of changed how I felt about it. And so gradually then I started looking into other women in history. And we have an author here in Astoria, Marianne Monson, and she's written a couple of wonderful books about women in history. And I've read several of hers. And it just gives you having the clothes and then learning what the women did, and realizing they did this in these dresses that are all the way to the ground. And and that's where Abigail, is it Abigail? Mrs. Bloomer, I think it was Abigail Bloomer, she said, how do you expect a woman carrying a baby and something else, maybe going up and down stairs with skirts that are around her ankles? It's so easy to fall. And so that's when she invented the bloomers, because she thought she would divide the skirt, tuck it in right underneath the knees so that it was safer to walk. I mean,
functionality.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep,
yeah, when you have to live in those confining sort of things, it's in the forefront of your mind.
Yeah, and you were saying the difference between the older and the more recent. When you are confined in a corset, you can barely take in a full breath. And then you've got stockings, you've got all the underwear, you've got all these layers and layers of clothes. And I imagined women in the South. I thought, how can they wear that in that heat and humidity when... many of us, if we were in that situation, would be barely having a tank top and some shorts on, which totally would not work back
no
in
1860. No wonder they were taken by the vapors. Is
yes,
that what that was?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Oh, and one more thing I wanted to add in there about Abigail Scott Duniway, because she is such a prominent character or part of women's history, mm-hmm. and especially as it relates to Oregon and the right to vote for women, is she not only was on horseback out there telling people about, you know, what needs to happen for voting, but
yeah.
she ran her own newspaper,
she
kind
did.
Of in counter to her, was it her brother?
Her brother, yes. Mm-hmm. And Harvey Duniway was the editor for the Oregonian, and he would write terrible editorials about why women shouldn't vote. They didn't know anything. And then she would counter with why they should vote in her newspaper. So they had this little thing going back and forth between Salem and Portland. Very interesting, you know, when your own brother doesn't want you to move forward.
Well, I'm glad it didn't stop her.
No, she persevered. And I think that clothing tells us so much about women's lives. And that's why it works well together, you know, to have the clothing. And I love doing the programs because I do include history and education, as well as the fun part of actually getting to see the real thing. You know, these are not costumes. They are what some actual woman really did wear and really did use, whether it's hats, topping it off, hankies with hanky-panky, amazing lace with lace, or gloves or shoes or whatever, you know, they are interested in seeing.
And before we wrap things up here, I would like to give you the opportunity to, what would you like to express to people who have questions about what best to do with things that are possibly family heirlooms that they'd like to know more
Good
about
question.
Or best way to mm-hmm. Preserve those?
I was just talking to my husband at lunch today, and I said, you know, people ought to frame these special pieces and enjoy them. And you can get UV glass and you can have it framed properly so that it is saving it. But enjoy it instead of tucking it away. And many people do call me because they don't have girls. They don't have any place. They don't want to send it to Goodwill. And so that's how I've really built my collection, is through the generosity of others that appreciate the clothing.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today such an interesting topic.
I think so.
And thank you for joining us here today on Your Coast Community Radio. This has been Lynn Hadley for Talking Story.